Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. The age of heroes has dawned and the quest for optimal wellness continues. Today, I'm proud to bring you The Art of Healing with Kak Young. Kak has 30 years of experience in the television industry, and she's written 28 books on metaphysics and self-improvement. Greetings and welcome, Kak. How are you tonight?
Thank you very much. I'm very well. It's really windy out here in California. It actually snowed on my patio.
Oh, wow.
The first time in 60 years. Yeah,
wow.
So it's exciting.
I bet. We were hearing here and we were concerned about you and everybody we know in California.
Well, thank you very much. There's one person we don't need to be concerned about, though, and that is Mr. Wayne White. He was a veteran, or is a veteran, of the U.S. Marine Corps, and he served as a civilian contractor in assignments around the globe for more than 25 years. And he has 3 years in the U.S. Antarctic program at the South Pole. Now, I just have one question for him. Wayne, you wrote a book called Cold, and you really described your three seasons at the South Pole, and you also say you never liked cold. So I'm going to ask you, why did you go?
Well, Kak, it's great meeting you tonight. Who'd have thought? Mount Olympus with Hercules? I mean, I'm pretty damned impressed right now. But let me say this, that I grew up in cold weather in the Midwest, and it wasn't something that appealed to me a lot at the time, and ended up joining the Marines years later when I was old enough and living in California for quite a while and then traveling the world mostly to equatorial places. I love the equatorial regions of the world and all that that brings with it, you know, the jungles and tropical areas and such and small islands that I worked on around the world, things I did. However, my big pull to do what I did in the U.S. Antarctic program was actually based on my love of history and the great explorers that the great race to the South Pole that occurred around 1911, 1912, and what these men faced back then, and in this incredibly harsh environment was enough to motivate me, to make me want to, you know, make that change to cold weather and, you know, almost unfathomable cold weather, really. But that was my big draw. It wasn't the Antarctic experience as much as what those explorers had faced, and I wanted to see and experience that. And I knew I would somewhat with a crew at the Amundsen Scott Station at the South Pole.
Wow. You know, I was, first of all, your book is fascinating, and I think everybody should read it. If they even have a slight grain of adventure in their bones. I mean, you really do describe this, and we'll get to your love of history in a minute. But I was very surprised to learn that the Amundsen Scott South Pole is a ship, and it sits on ice. Well, it's not like a boat, but you still call it a ship. Can you tell us about this amazing place?
Yeah, I sure can, and I call it a ship. I make that claim in my book, and I think I had some pretty good information or facts that support that. Of course, it's a structure. It's sitting on pillars on 2 miles of ice, but it's moving with this 2 miles of ice. It has a crew. We call our groups crews down there. We eat in a galley. We have an observation deck. We have a lifeboat, which is our last refuge should we lose all power and services down there. So it get used, and I saw it as a ship. But it's a fascinating place, and you know, 90 degrees south, one of the harshest environments in the world. Temperatures in the winter time, which are most of the year, February 15th to around November 1st, can go below minus 100 Fahrenheit. You have high winds that can drive wind chill factors to minus 140 below zero, and you've got a crew of around 42 that will experience that cold from around February 15th all the way till November 1st with no way out. And I should say, too, much of that time will be in 24-hour darkness with no light. So it's there's no experience really like it on the planet, and that was a big draw for me, and that was really the subject of the book.
Well, now, you call it a ship, but can it sink?
It actually does, in a way. Every year the ice builds up at around 12 inches or so, and past the current Amundsen-Scott South Pole Station is the third rendition from the original old pole, which occurred around 1956, 1957, went on for a number of years. And then the iconic dome structure that was down there after old pole had basically sunk beneath the rising ice. And then even old pole, that geodesic dome that you'll see old photos of, ended up, instead of being level, was in a bowl of sorts and was being, you know, eaten or enveloped, let's say, by the ice. So it can't sink, so to speak, but it will be overcome by the rising ice there. And that's the beautiful thing about Amundsen-Scott Station, that it sits on pillars that can be raised.
Well, you talked about in the book, you have like an almost poetic description of February 15th and the changeover. Talk to us a little bit about that.
You know, we just went through it February 15th, and I have to say, you know, I was back there thinking about what that day was all about. When this crew of 42 or thereabout that number, the summer population can be upwards to 150 from November 1st until that February 15th day. But on February 15th, they're all gone except for that winter crew. And that winter crew is going to then see that last aircraft take the remaining people out and realize that they won't see another aircraft until the end of October or sometime in November, which during my 2020 year, the COVID year, it was 3 weeks into November before anybody came to get us out of there. So that time is a time when people they've made the commitment that they're going to stay there, and on that day there's no way out. And I love that day. I loved it the three times I experienced it. I never had an issue with it. But I wondered about some of my crew members. Were they concerned? I mean, you should be concerned, really, if you're sane, I think.
Yeah. Well, now, why do we even have a structure or a ship at the South Pole? Why do we need that?
Yeah, and again, I call it a ship. It is a structure. It is a structure, although it moves with the ice and has certain ship type of nomenclature and such. But we need it because of the fact that they do some very cool science there. They have some major science projects with the MAPO, the Marmarantz Observatory that's there, and the BICEP Array, the South Pole Telescope, the Ice Cube Project. And our National Oceanic Administration Group has a basically the farthest south weather station, if you can call it that, that does ozone readings and all kinds of other things. So it's all about science. And the National Science Foundation is the governmental group that administers it and then contracts it out. And I was a contractor to get done what's done there.
Well, cool. Now, you had to go through a lot of, I'm laughing as I say this, because you had to go through a lot of applications and a lot of questioning, and they asked you one question, like, you know, which is on all of our minds, why do you want to go there? And your answer was pretty fascinating. You said, because?
Because I can't go to Mars. And interestingly enough, I spoke at the Mars Society Convention in Tempe, Arizona, a couple of months ago, and was able to tell that story because I couldn't go to Mars. That would be the closest thing that I was ever going to get to that. And interestingly enough, once while I was down there in the summer, my boss came to me and said, Wayne, there's some NASA people here. I want them to meet you and tell them why you're here. And then I told them the story, because I can't go to Mars. And, unless one of those rich guys wants to shoot me up there, an aging explorer, and I am ready to go, I probably won't be making that journey. But a South Pole winter and having the crew live in the conditions we lived in, it's probably about as close as anything that's going to happen on the planet.
Well, I want to stick with training for a minute because there's one sentence. If someone is applying for a job with you and you interviewed a lot of people, once you said, because I can't go to Morris, they said, fine, we're going to make you captain because you are extremely cool and sure, we'll do this. Then you had to interview a lot of people and there's one thing, one answer they give and you say, okay, it's over. Tell me what that is.
Yeah. Well, you know, what happens is, and I had some fun with it in the book, but it is true, and that is you'll have a few, every now and then someone will come in there, and when you ask them that question, why do you want to go to the South Pole, they'll say, I've always wanted to see a polar bear. Well, when they said that, there are no polar bears in the Southern Hemisphere, and that does indicate a lack of research, which, you know, could lead to other things, and I write humorously about that in the book, but it's based on something. It's based on, really, lack of research, and they'll get down there and certainly be disappointed when they see no polar bears.
Exactly. Yeah, but that's pretty funny. Okay, so now you go, you get them through, you hire all your 42 people and you have to weed them out for, as you describe, personality issues and mental health and stamina and commitment. And so now you put them through a little bit of boot camp. Tell us about what you do to them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, let me go back a little to the interview process, because the one of the things I'm very proud about my book is if someone is interested in working in the U.S. Antarctic program, it's the best that I've seen out there that describes the interview process, the kind of things people go for, the kind of things we look for. And I use some humor in it and stuff, but it really is good for that, for any budding Antarctic, and at least for the South Pole winter experience. It's different in the other places. But what we do with people is the first thing, CAC, is that, you know, you hiring people over the phone is problematic, so we make them then go to a face-to-face interview. Once they get through all that, they get through a really incredible medical screening and all that, then what we would do is do some team-building training up at Estes Park in the mountains of Colorado. And that was an interesting thing, and I was a bit of a skeptic, and our guy, Sean Dunning, who ran that program, this was no, you know, trust falls and group hugs and sing songs and such. We put people in these small groups and had them do problem solving. One problem solving event was the creation of a boat made out of cardboard that would then be raced in a pool up there at the site at Estes Park. And we weren't interested really in the winners and the great designs and all that, but what we were interested in is watching the people work together as a team, because there are people who are good at it and there are people that are not good at it. And it's all about the team, you know, teamwork and being able to peacefully coexist with somebody for a year down there. So that team building, you know, puts them through that rite of passage. At the same time, then either after or before, depending on the year, they'll run through a week-long fire school to be a fire person right out of Denver there, and then, or a medical training course to be a wilderness, like EMT type. So we've got some time to see the people under some stress prior to a deployment, and then hopefully you've got time during that summer prior to the station closing to watch how they do down there. So, you know, it's quite a process to become a winner over, actually be standing there when that last aircraft flies out.
So what could possibly get on fire other than the kitchen on a ship at 140 degrees minus?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I talked to a fire chief down there once. It was, and I said, the good thing I think about this station is it shouldn't burn very easily. And he concurred that it shouldn't. But, you know, fires are fires. Once they get things get going, it's amazing what will burn. And the way I looked at it, because my background prior to doing project management and running projects around the world is environmental health and safety. So I'm always looking out for problems, whether it's a safety problem that would hurt people or whether it's an environmental thing. So I walked through that station with the fire chief, and we looked at some things. Thing is, a fire, for example, could easily happen in like a power plant with fuels and such things, and electrical fires. You lose your power plant, you lose your heating. That can be a real problem. Will the station burn that easily? You know, probably not, but it can still burn. There's places that would burn, and with enough heat, who knows how badly it would burn. So the point, CAC, is that what we really practiced was fire prevention. You know, that's what you practice first, and then fire surveillance with a pretty good fire alarm system that always needed some tweaking, but it was a pretty good system. So fire is something that even like on a ship, when we would hire people, if they were from the Navy, that was always a good, if you're on a Navy ship, firefighting's huge because there's no calling 911. There's no, you know, help's coming. You got to fight that fire, and Navy firefighters are really superb. So it was the kind of thing we never wanted to face, but we always wanted to be ready for 24 hours a day.
Well, yeah, that sounds very smart. Now, why is 42 the magic number for members on each mission?
Yeah, it's interesting how that is, and if I had an org chart, I could kind of show you. But it's around that number. I had one group that was 45, it turned out to be. I said 46, but I forgot. We didn't hire one position. So we were really at 45. Most crews are 42, and that is, they determine, at least for now, is enough to cover the science projects and then to do all the other things that need to be done, like the vehicle maintenance, the galley, the IT, you know, computer stuff, satellite things, the station maintenance, and some of the other facets to keep the station up and operational and to be collecting science data. That's kind of what they come through. It could change if we automate some systems and things. And my guess is in the future the number will be lower, particularly if they ever build a new station. It'll probably be a smaller station. But that's the number that works right now, right around there.
Wow. So what is the best job on the ship and what's the worst?
You know, I mean, I thought mine was. I just you know, loved what I did. I just, you know, it was the kind of thing where it just fit me. It fit me where I was in life. And, you know, I write about it in the book, a lot about, you know, my perspective and such. And it might be different than other people's on leadership. I took things pretty extreme that way. But it's because of the past that I had that a lot of people that had been in that position haven't had. The worst, I would say, would probably be the steward. And by worst, it's not. It would just be one of the hardest. And that you end your you're working in a kitchen, and your job is to do pots and pans, and wash dishes and clean things. And we've just had some terrific stewards, but that's a job that really gets old. And fortunately, the crews will step in and help because the stewards all start off very enthusiastic, and some during the year kind of wear down. And the crew will come in and help. But I had the wonderful people that were stewards and crews that always help. But I had to do the dish pit myself. We all do on a we call it dish pit on a periodic basis. And I was a dishwasher when I was in high school as a kid. And let me tell you, those skills are long forgotten. I gotta get stuck in this room with pots and pans piled up and burnt things on it that I don't even know what it was because I don't cook. I don't know how to cook. All I see is these burnt pots and pans. How do I get that stuff off? You know, all these different pieces of machinery. I don't even know what it is. We all face that. We were all on dish pit on a periodic basis. But I'll say the steward is the unsung hero of the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station.
Well, Wayne, if you ever have to do that again, just stick those burnt pots outside the window and let them freeze the gook off.
Maybe that would have worked. I never
that
thought of that.
I
found another technique that worked for me.
Okay, good. You have a charming passage about Thanksgiving on the ship. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Thanksgiving has always been one of my favorite holidays because it's so inclusive of you know, everyone can be thankful for things, no matter what race, religion, ethnic, I mean, whatever the heck you are. Just Thanksgiving as a day to give thanks for what you have is a wonderful thing. So it's always been probably my favorite holiday. And it's no different at the South Pole. They would have these incredible dinners. The whole station would be there, and this is during the summer, so it's light out, and you've got, you know, over 100 people in the station. But these cooks they have are truly, truly great chefs that love, you know, showcasing their work. And, I mean, Thanksgiving dinners down there are wonderful events. And like I used to, you know, like to say, if you give thanks for nothing else, give thanks that you're at the South Pole.
Yeah, indeed. Now, do you have any kind of religious services on the ship for people who might practice?
Yeah, it depends on the year. I found that the program runs a little bit, I don't want to say anti-religious, but it's not. I would say it isn't. You don't may have a necessarily same percentage of people that go to church and things with a South Pole crew for whatever reason. They just most of the people march to a different drummer. However, there are people that want to get together. In my first year, I had Brett, who was an ordained minister, and he also then worked in supply. But he was a lovely fellow who would conduct these non-denominational services that were more just get-togethers and things. And if people wanted to do that, it was something that could be done. But it wasn't something that we looked to do, or we had a checklist that said we will do it. It was up to the crew and how much they wanted to do it. My first year, they were pretty active. Second year, not as much. But there's always people that take that stuff seriously, and they certainly should be respected.
So tell me about the sunrise and the sunset at the South Pole. Mm-hmm. You are quite taken by those moments. Tell us what they're like, Wayne.
There's nothing quite like it. The sunset at the South Pole takes time. If you look at a chart for the day and light at the South Pole, it starts getting dim right after the last aircraft flies out on February 15th. The reason they picked that date is because that's when the temperatures start getting below like minus 60 or so. And once you start getting much colder than that, it'll freeze fuel and hydraulic fluids and such. So that's why the February 15th station closing date, as they call it, happens. Now, what you'll see from that February time frame on, it's going from 24 hours of light to the sun just slowly setting. It's circling, and it's getting lower and lower on the horizon. You get these long shadows because it's so low on the horizon. Finally, it starts getting to where it's going below, beneath the surface, and then this darkness sets in different stages. They have what they call nautical darkness, and then they have astronomical twilight, I guess they call it, and different stages of darkness. But finally, it's dark. The sun is gone, and it's not going to come back. So what happens on those dates that's pretty fascinating is because the station has lights inside and it would be emitting through the windows, the aurora cameras that are on the roof would be affected. So you cover all the windows from the inside with cardboard. What that does is essentially darkens the outside of the station except for these red lights, and inside it kind of closes you in. It's a date that people really seem to enjoy because that's the date the station truly takes on a whole new being with those windows covered. No light, no way out. You're really in that station. They're just as motivated by the return of the light months later, and when you start to see a little glimmer on the horizon, that's a big day for people. And that sun comes up, and they want to get those window covers off now because they want to see that sun again. But it's a real rite of passage for any South Pole winter over, both those occurrences.
Well, in your book, you have some really stunning pictures. I mean, even if people don't want to read it, they should buy it just for the pictures alone. They're absolutely stunning. And you have, I believe you're in the picture with the auroras. Someone else might have been taking it, and you've got the auroras as this canopy over you.
I think that's Dr. Jeffrey Chan. That's one of my favorite photos, and he took my cover photo, actually. But if it's the one with the red, looks like red on the ice, that's just kind of an optical effect. What happens at the South Pole is we didn't have down there the wonderful sea life and whales and penguins. Everybody loves penguins. Everybody loves penguins, and we don't have anything at the South Pole. There's no animals. There's nothing. It's all dead for many, many hundreds of miles in every direction. But what there is down there is these night skies that are really incredible. And when you get that aurora, that green aurora australis, like the aurora borealis from the north, but it's in the south, it makes just an eerie, incredible light that I used to love to walk, get out of that station, get out of ways under the light of that aurora. Just magnificent.
Well, now, speaking of walking, you do tell your people on board, you do tell your crew, there's death outside that window. You warn them.
Yeah.
And yet, Wayne, you walked over 3,000 miles on your tours out there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty darn cold out there, my friend. What were you doing?
Yeah, it's interesting because that statement I used, I say in the book, I wasn't being melodramatic. I wanted to just get through people's minds that it was dangerous out there and they needed to be careful. With proper precautions, wearing your proper clothing, using your radios, being careful, not doing something stupid out there, you're going to be quite safe. Now, I ended up actually 4,300 miles outside. And what that was all about was every day I would go out. I never missed a day. One of the reasons being because it was my call whether or not we suspended outside operations due to weather. And so I go out there and look around, but I use that kind of as an excuse. The fact of the matter is I enjoyed that walking. And I like everything, I approached it very, very, very cautiously. That it's a dangerous thing, and even getting – you know, some distance from that station, you don't have to be far, and things could take a real bad turn if should something happen to you, should you fall down, should you have a medical emergency or something. So I took it very, very seriously, was very, very cautious. And through the years I was there, I learned more and more how to do it safely, successfully. I never took anything for granted. I was careful. But I was away from that station out in that darkness, and it was really nothing like it. It was just something that drew me to be out there alone and do that. I just loved it. I have to say I wouldn't have enjoyed it. If it would have been one of my crew members, I would have had a problem with it. I would have been worried about him. But I was careful.
Well, you even jogged out there. You got your exercise
in the summertime.
Ice.
Yeah, a few people do. In the summertime, they actually have a South Pole Marathon where they run around the station a number of times, and they put that many miles in. So there are athletes out there that you'll see in the summer, but that stops in the winter. It becomes dark and too cold for that type of thing. But everybody in that station, not everybody, some don't, but a number of people have to go outside for things in course of business during that long, dark, cold winter. The science people all have to go out on the flag line and get to their science facilities. Our maintenance people have to go out and do their rounds and check things like where we get our water from and some of the other buildings that are out there. And our IT people, communications, have to head out sometimes to this satellite dome. So when you get on one of those crews, you could very well find yourself out there. And it's never anything to take lightly. Nothing has happened to date, knock on wood somewhere. I'm just not doing it, actually, knock on wood. But there have been people nearly lost, and to be lost there would be really bad.
I would imagine that it's extremely difficult to navigate on a totally black and very cold night. Do you have markers up there? Are there flashers? People know how to get back? Yeah.
For all the people that are going out to do their work, they're walking, they're on flag lines. Flag line being a bamboo pole with a red flag on it that's got also usually a reflective strip, and they're wearing a headlamp. So they're on that flag line, and every 20 feet or so is another bamboo pole. So you go pole to pole. Most days, most nights, you're doing that, you can see down the flag line, you'll see the red lights on the building you're trying to get to, but you can get in some situations there where the weather takes a turn, particularly when the high winds come in, and when that happens, all bets are off, and that's where the danger happens, is when you would lose your visibility. And I used to practice that. I learned to practice in the summer. I would go out from the station, and we hit some bad weather sometimes, and I'd spin around and try to disorient myself and then get back. And it wasn't easy to do, mostly just by the wind direction and stuff. But I would practice that kind of thing. And I was always dressed so warmly enough that I was fine. I wasn't ever going to freeze to death. That wasn't going to happen. But, you know, other things could happen. The point is everybody that's out there should be on a flag line, and most are.
Well, now, I think you wrote in the book that you kind of got lost once. You got disoriented and you had to find your way back.
I wasn't lost. What it was is I knew how to get back, but I couldn't find something out there. I was looking for this mile and a half airfield marker that's a large, like a sign that's just black is all it is. It's used for their pilots when they take off. And I couldn't find it. I knew where the station was. I could get back, but it was so dark. And to get out there, I'm navigating using these stars. When I start, I look at this star and go, it's probably under about that. And then I'd walk out from the station. This one was about a mile and a half out. And I couldn't find it. And I'm doing these little grids and walking around, and I couldn't find it. And then I started walking back in. I ran into something else that oriented me, and I went back out again and found it. I was never lost as far as from the station. I just simply couldn't find that thing out there. That was, and it kind of threw me.
Ah, yeah,
hard
well, there you go. What is the preparation, the personal preparation, mentally and physical, to go for this nine-month winter in a place that you just can't leave? I mean, I'll ask you that in a minute, what if somebody needs to leave, but how do you prepare for that?
Well, you know, I'll speak kind of for the crew. With myself, I've been doing this for a long time, been gone at places around the globe, never for where I couldn't get out in that kind of length of time, but still I was kind of used to that. The crew members, I think the main thing is that they had to make sure that things were well with their family, their families and their pets and things like that. The deployment stuff, we'll get them through that. We'll get them through the clothes they need. We issue, you know, they issued the U.S. Antarctic Program issues almost everything, but there's some personal things that we would help them get to make sure that they had the stuff they needed to make it through a winter, comfort type items, foods, drinks, things like that they could order in and maybe have a stock for a while. But I think the main thing was, you know, making sure that things were good with their families, and because that had caused problems in the past, and I saw a few issues on my cruise that really difficult to deal with a distraught crew member and something going on thousands of miles away and no way for them to handle it.
Yeah, now, I mean, they have wives, they have families, they have parents and things, and I would imagine that things could happen to any one of those members. How do you guys handle a trauma like that?
Yeah, you know, it's the best thing about the South Pole crews are the ones I was on, and I'm sure most all of the crews are really good about taking care of people and being sensitive to people that are having a hard time. And I had, during my time down there, I had a couple of unforeseen divorces, which are nice if a person finds out they're going to be divorced and they didn't know that when they left. And then I had at least one death, and that was a couple of deaths actually, and other things where people had issues that occurred at home. And if I could help, I did. I had a, you know, of course, I write in my book a lot about my leadership, the way I did it, and my distance I kept from my crew, and I did that for a purpose, and there was a reason. But the fact of the matter is when it came down to be able to talk and be able to talk through issues, I was always there, and I spent many hours talking to crew members in my office about things that, you know, I mean, some very, very tragic things that were occurring, you know, with family members off ice or other issues that they were having. But the crews, the best thing isn't for me to do it as the winter manager. The best thing was when the crews got together. And I write about that in the book, about how they would pull together. I watched a couple of them once take a guy that was quite intoxicated back to his room, and I was following behind him. And I just was so impressed by, you know, the care and concern they had for their crew member.
Well, yeah, I would imagine that a whole family is created. Now, do you guys keep in touch? Do you have bowling shirts and special rings?
Yeah.
I mean, are you?
Well, we actually have rings. We had rings for our last crew. We have numbers. One of the Antarctic historian, a very great man named Bill Spindler, keeps a database of all the South Pole winter overs. We have numbers. My number is 1522. I have a ring that says that, and it has my, I think, three winners or something like that on there. But we do keep in touch. There's Facebook groups or things. And I mean, tragically, I learned of a terrible accident that killed one of my 2020 crew members recently, and I spoke at his service in Washington State.
Oh, that's very sad. But what wonderful of you to go, though, and represent that extraordinary time in his life.
It was a big deal for him, and he was a wonderful guy, and I mentioned him by name in my book. If I had a son, that kid, I would have loved to have had him. I've never had kids, and then this happened, so it hit me doubly hard. He was more than just a crew member. I just thought the world of this kid, and he didn't know it, but I told him when I was leaving after a year. I saw him at the door when I was leaving the station. I took him aside, and I told this guy, kid, his name was Nathan. I said, Nathan, you know, I've led a wayward life. I've been around and done many things. Never had children, but if I had kids, I'd love to have had you for a son.
Aww.
And he actually contacted his father, told him it meant a lot to him. And his father contacted me and said, boy, what you said to my son meant a lot. And I was very happy to hear that, and, of course, very saddened to hear that Nathan died in an air crash in Washington State recently.
Ah, oh, gee, I'm so sorry to hear that. Well,
good kid.
He died with fabulous memories.
Oh, he did. He did. He led the life that was, you know, and he was on a test. He's doing aircraft testing, and that has inherent dangers, you know. That's the kind of life. But the kind of people that we have at the South Pole, they're just, you know, wonderful folks, very, very diverse in you know, interests and things, and different than what I had seen at the islands and other remote sites I'd worked around the world, but very, very touching, and I was really honored to be their leader.
Well, that is, you know, that is very wonderful how you address that in the book, and I thought it was, you know, extremely brave, and I loved your comment when someone asked you about serving in the military, and you said, you know, I want to do something in my life where no one will ever have life or death power over me.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I'm a Marine,
so you went to the end of the earth.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've been around the world and I've done things. You know, I just barely mentioned a few things that have happened where I've been, you know, expeditions and things that I've done around the world. Some very, very intriguing and some somewhat perilous situations. But the Marines, which I'm always proud to be that I was a member of the Marines, but I never wanted anyone to have that power over me again. That was something where I did my time. Till the day I die, I'll be a Marine, but I don't want anyone to have that kind of power over me again. And I haven't had that since then.
Well, yes, except nature. You did give your power away to nature.
Yeah, I have nothing to say with that.
Yeah. Now, you are an avid art collector and a historian.
Yeah.
Wayne, tell me about that.
Oh, boy. Yeah, if you saw the room I'm sitting in right now, I chose this room tonight. I'm in the green room of my old house here in Rockport, Texas, and I'm looking at one cabinet, and on top of it is a number of things that were related to the great African explorer Henry Morton Stanley. Old photographs, old autographs, a couple of old statues, and then his personal ring, his actual ring that he wore, Henry Morton Stanley. He's a guy that said Dr. Livingston, I presume, as a matter of fact. So I'm looking at that, and up here from here I've got a great bronze of Captain Richard Francis Burton, and a letter he wrote, a postcard, a Christmas card from his wife, a picture of his wife. Down below here is some stuff from Dr. David Livingston, a piece of wood that was from the tree where they buried his heart in Africa, a spoon that he owned that has his initials on it from his African expeditions, and a piece of wood that was from the bough of the tree that carried his body across Africa. The house is filled with these things, and it creates quite an aura. And that's why I wanted to be in here tonight and talking to you, to the energy that comes from stuff like this. So I was, you know, through these years, I've collected and collected and collected, but it wasn't so much one of these hoarder ownership type things where I got stacks of buttons that I found in the street. You know, it's more themed, and it's mostly ethnic type, exploration type, old artifacts and such. They create this kind of very cool, at least for me, atmosphere in this great old house that I have here. You know, and that's the thing. I'm collecting for the aura and for the visuals, not you know, for just to own something. Because what I've learned, especially as I've gotten older, is we don't own anything. We're just stewards for a while.
Yeah, we just rent. So this brings me to a statement you made in the book where you had to call your wife, like, urgently, and it was very, and you wanted to make sure she picked up something off the carpet. Now, what was that, Wayne?
Well, I use it because it's such a ridiculous thing, but it shows what can happen also in my life, because my life is a bit different. And so my wife sends this photo to me of, I have many cats. It's in the book. I love cats and I have many cats. And she sends this picture and says, this is Tina. She got her head stuck in these blinds. She knocked all these things on the floor, and here's what she did. And I remember Tina doing something similar some time ago when I was home for a little while. Anyway, I looked at the photo and just thought, oh, gosh, there goes Tina, because she's kind of a crazy little cat. Then I'm laying in bed, and then it hit me. Oh, God, those are poison darts from the Amazon laying on the floor. And I thought, oh, my God. My wife could step on the poison darts. A cat could step on them. They maybe fell out of the container they were in. And I run to the phone. I get on the Iridium phone there in the office and call her and go, Melissa, poison darts on the floor. Oh, I already knew that, and I put them away in a cabinet. Well, I go back to bed, and it hit me. I just called the South Pole to tell my wife that there's poison darts on the floor of our house. You know, you got to start reevaluating your life.
Now, what's the time difference between the South Pole and Texas?
Mm. Yeah, it was something like 7 or 8 hours. It depended on we didn't go to daylight time down there or something. It was like 7 or 8 hours, and we were I think we were a day ahead of them, but 7 or 8 hours behind. And then you could only call. The internet was spotty. You got a few hours a day on the internet. But we did have this Iridium phone that worked most of the time.
Wow. Well, all right. So I've written 3 cat books, so I'm interested. How many cats do you have?
it's funny. I try never to count them because if I count them, it becomes real. And then the other day, I've used this number 20, right? And then the other day my wife sent me a Christmas card. It was a card. It was a Valentine's card, and it had all their names on there. And she gave it to me, and I looked at it. The first thing I wanted to see is, did she get all the names? And I'm going through, and I see, she forgot Paul. How could you forget Paul? Then I count them. It's like 23. Oh,
ooh.
We got a lot of cats.
That's a lot of kitties.
Let me explain. We've got a pretty good property here. I got my old house on the ocean, then a house behind. Pretty understanding neighbors on each side. It's a pretty good-sized property. The cats are divided into different groups. There's a couple that have just medical issues that are inside only, a few of those. Some inside, outside, a number, then there's some that are outside. They're spread around enough, and I have to keep this place clean. I mean, we're constantly cleaning and filtering the air and doing what we have to do because I don't want to turn that corner into one of these people with the horrible situations, which is quite frankly, Kak, where these cats came from. None of these are pet store cats. Many of them have horrible stories. And we took them in, and their price of admission was a spay and neuter. That happened instantly because there's too many little kitties out there. But I love cats, and so does my wife, but we've got a lot.
So you're going to have to change or add a name to your, Wayne White Hemingway, I think, just to be clear.
Well, it's interesting, the parallels, not with he's a great writer, I'm not, but as far as the lifestyle and the things and the travels and being in the wars and then on the ocean here in this community and then having these cats, because I'm before seeing you tonight, I was trying to do some stuff on the internet, and I got my little buddy Colton who's bothering me, who all of a sudden wants to play with the mouse, the computer mouse, not the real mouse, but I love these guys, and they've really taught me a lot. I've been gone so many years and never had pets, and now all of a sudden, to see these guys and see these fights for survival and things that happen. And not having children, I didn't see what so many people have faced, having a kid and watching that wonderful, I hope wonderful, transition, through their lives. But I have cats, and I've learned a lot from them.
Yeah, well, they're fascinating creatures. And you couldn't take any of them to the South Pole, right?
No, but, I wish I could have. I wish I could have. Unfortunately, the Antarctic Treaty forbids it to have an animal down there. But if you look at the 1957 first winter rover groups, the next winter, 58, there was a dog, Bravo. I think they brought another one. There used to be dogs down there. And if the crew had a dog, it would probably be a good thing. I actually made the argument once during a kind of a big meeting on why we should have it, and the environmental people, they were very, very understanding, but they just said we just can't with the treaty like it is with the no animals. But I'll tell you, Kak, if I could have had my cat Colton or Ginger down there, oh, my God, my winter would have been so much better.
Great. Now, here's my question for you. You're married, and how does your wife Yes, she has, you know, the cats to keep her company. How does she deal with that?
Well, the thing is, that was a kind of a tough one. We've worked around the world together for a number of years, too, so she's seen that side. But I'll just say that it was something that, because of the fact we worked around the world and she'd been in these other places, and then she would leave maybe, and maybe she wasn't there. It kind of works. It's worked with us. I'm not saying it hasn't caused, you know, damage and things being gone so long. Any relationship is going to suffer somewhat. You just got to do some time sometimes. And I was gone for so long, but I did learn during the last year or two to try to be in more contact, like everyday emails, try to call more when I could and such, because I was just getting more and more distant. And that she's here in this old house trying to take care of things. She's a teacher. That's what she does. Teaches elementary school. And I see now that I've been home for a while, how much work she had to do with me gone. And it's really staggering what she had to do.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I used to have six cats. Now I have three, and it just three is a lot of work, but you have multiples of
that. Yeah. Yeah. She's real quick. One thing about my wife, Melissa, is she's very efficient and fast when she does things, much more than I am. I have to think about it a little bit, whether it's feeding them or whatever, but she's very fast and organized that way. And it's a fact that she's working as a teacher, which is, boy, that's a hard job. And then taking care of these guys, plus this old house and, you know, things that happen. It's a lot of work. It really is.
Well, you hit gold when you married her, Wayne.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, interesting thing. We've been together a long time, and it works. We're different in a lot of ways. She's left-handed and left-brained, and she's artistic, and she likes color. I'm the opposite. I like drab things and muted colors and browns and things. You should see our closet. One side's all these khaki shirts, looks militaristic. Her side has got pinks and blues and purples and all these things. But you know what? It works because the basic human values were there. You know, it's those things we're together on. But we're quite different as people.
Well, I got to admit one thing to you. I'm going to ask you about Buzz Aldrin. But I have to say that there was a time when I was dating Buzz Aldrin's sister's ex-husband, and
really?
So,
okay, well,
so I was fascinated by the story of when Buzz came to visit the South Pole.
Yeah, he was, I write about it in the book, and it was a big deal because we didn't learn about it very much in advance, and he was a tourist. He was on a tour group. It was like a French company that put this, my God, it must have been, to go to the South Pole like he did, that's like a $90,000 trip. And they just go down there for 2 hours, walk around a little bit, and fly out. They're usually really wealthy people. So having Buzz Aldrin on that trip was probably a big draw, and all these rich people then would really want to do a trip like that.
Sure.
So he gets there, and he's sick. And I understand he was probably sick before he left, you know, before he even started on the thing. And who wants to say they're sick? He gets down there, and he had these medical issues right away. We took him into the station, and we ended up medevacing him out. But, you know, it's fascinating. I spent just a couple of minutes talking to him, and he saw my Explorers Club hat, and, my God, he's probably the most prominent member, as far as I'm concerned, in the Explorers Club. And then I'm talking to this guy, and I'm thinking, I'm standing there, just him and I, and he's laying in his bed with tube in his nose, and we're talking, and I'm thinking, I remember being this kid, as a kid at a public swimming pool in Des Moines, Iowa, hearing the eagle has landed, and then going home to this grainy black and white television set and watching these guys, Neil Armstrong and then Buzz on the moon. And I'm talking to this guy at the South Pole later in life. I mean, it really is interesting. And you know, he's an unusual individual anyway. I mean, truly a character. And all I was thinking, I would have loved to have really talked to him because I wanted to write more, but I didn't, about what it must be like to be him. You've stood on the moon, and now after that, what happens? And he's had his issues. He had things in life. It must not have been easy with that, you know, with standing on the moon, you know, doing what he did. Your whole life would change, and that wouldn't be easy. And that's kind of what I was thinking when I saw him there. I was kind of thinking of that type of thing.
Sure. He'll tell you, look, I'm just an engineer. That's all I am. I'm just an engineer. And I, you know,
quite an engineer.
Up there. So he's got a real streak of deep humility in him. But he got sick, and then you saved his tissue, his Kleenex, and you guys have it in a shrine out there at South Pole.
I picked it up off the floor. I picked it up off the floor as a joke because I had these research associates, and they both were these kind of budding potential astronauts. They both could have been. And at the time, I thought maybe they'd, you know, go try to go into the astronaut program, as some of the polies do, the science people. Every now and then, one will. And so as a joke, I presented them this tissue and said, this was the tissue that Buzz Aldrin used while he was sitting in that chair. There's a picture of it. And then later, you know, these guys took it to the next level, and Buzz's tissue with his body fluids are now preserved in the ice tunnels of the South Pole. So hopefully we can clone him in a few thousand years and make another one.
Well, sure. Now, does Buzz know about this? Have you told him?
I don't know. I don't know if he does or doesn't. I'd love to tell him the story. By now, maybe someone's told him. If my book gets out there enough, he'll find out.
Immortalized
at the South Pole.
Yeah, let me see what I can do. So anyway, I want to get back to you and this book and how fabulous I think it is. It's called Cold, and it's Three Winters at the South Pole by Wayne White, and it's available wherever you get your books. And it's a fascinating story and it's much broader than just, okay, we did this and we did that and we did this. Wayne really describes a lot of the psychology behind what happens, and you have great heart. You know, you even admit to some of your own flaws and how you've worked those out. But it's just a stunning capture of one of the most adventurous things anyone can do, besides maybe go to the moon, and these other people can go up there and fly around, but unless they walk on it. I mean, I think you and Buzz would be great friends if we got you together. So would you go back, Wayne?
You know, I was thinking about that today. I've done three, and I, you know, the last winter was a bit rough, and I had some issues too with the program overall, which I don't go into in the book much. I didn't want any sour grapes, but I had a few issues with what I thought, and a little bit different, you know, philosophy than mine. I don't know. You know, I know this from my life, though. Never say never. You know, things could happen. I just think that the problem with it is that I've already kind of hit this perfect spot with the three. Would it be good to do four or five or whatever? I don't know. The other thing is now that I've been home and I see the enormous things my wife has to do, it would be so difficult to be over there and to think about her with these cats and all that stuff. But listen, thanks for the plug for my book. It was, you know, I did the best I could with it. I actually had a, early on, the publisher, Potomac Books, gave me a little thing, and it was a page and a half of notes on it, and they said, Wayne, take a look at this, and you don't have to do anything. Just look at it. And one of the comments in there was, in your book, you write all these things, but we don't know you. We don't know you. And I purposely, my first renditions of that were more of a third-party observer. And then I said, okay, well, you want to know me. And then, heck, I run horribly afraid of this writing yourself the hero of your book, of your novel or whatever. And that's a natural tendency. And I mean, I've done some things. I've done some, you know, heroic type things that people would be interested in. But again, blowing your own horn like that. So I've been peppered with things to make it more of a memoir that told some things about me. And they weren't always flattering. And I thought maybe people, you know, would enjoy that, or they, you know, they might find that interesting, because there's the people that are going to read it because they want to read about Antarctica, and there's people that are going to want to read it maybe for the psychological thing. I'm an unusual person. I really live in the past. I love history. I have an ego. I have all these things that I have to constantly be aware of, and I'm fairly self-aware. And so there's things in there that, you know, I don't know, you know, whatever people think, great. It's up to the reader. I put it out there.
Well, it's a fascinating read, like I said, and it really is the tale of a person who makes a decision to go down to the South Pole, or do you call it up? It's down, right? It's down under.
It's down.
Yeah.
We call it down.
And
down under. Right?
And live and perform science and great service to our planet. We can learn a lot from the very, very cold. And the picture on the front of your book is you at 98 degrees below zero and with icicles hanging from your eyelashes. It's a fantastic book. I recommend it completely. And again, Amazon, wherever you get your books. And Wayne, you've been a fabulous guest, and I wish you, Melissa, and all the kitties a very, very good and wonderful life together. And I hope that if you go again, you'll write Cold 2.
Keck, you are a wonderful interviewer. Obviously, you know that, but you've really pulled some interesting things out tonight, and I've enjoyed this.
Well, I've had a ball, and I'm going to turn this back over to the mighty Hercules on Mount Olympus with my thanks to you, Wayne. And here you go, Hercules. Take it away.
Thank you very much, Keck, and thank you, Wayne. The age of heroes has indeed dawned, and you're a hero in the Greek sense of the word, because the Greek heroes were very human, and that comes with foibles as well as brilliances. So thank you very much to both of you.
It was an honor.
Thank you. Bye, Wayne. Stay warm.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Good night, and thanks to all our listeners. Whether you called and you're patiently waiting in our queue, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand, until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, everyone.